Welcome. Continuing the story, the long ancient saga of how all this comes to be and doesn't come to be. There's an aspect of everything we could call the mystery. The way this world appears to arise very mysteriously. We'll never know quite how it appears the way it does in this moment-to-moment, ever-changing way that it does. And all things have this mysterious aspect. And I think we all have some sense of that. And we notice it sometimes in the form of beauty. When we're struck by beauty, I think that actually what we're being struck by is this mysterious nature of the way things are appearing to arise, and that we can't actually understand it. We're in touch with the mysterious aspect of it, like this crab apple tree outside the door here, raining white snow petals. It knows how to do that and when to do that each spring. It's like a miracle when we're open to the mystery of it. Often we're not, and so we don't even notice the tree, especially if after a few days of it looking like that, we lose touch with its mysterious aspect. But sometimes we can just walk out the door and just see it, boom, and be struck by the mystery and the beauty. I think they're the same thing. Maybe beauty is the form in which the mystery appears. Or to a human consciousness, the mystery, when the mystery strikes it directly, we call that beauty. So often nature strikes us in this way. An amazing sunset, or a forest, or a mountaintop. The beauty can overwhelm us. And I think it's because it's beyond our comprehension, what's going on there. And it's impermanent, fleeting. And another aspect of this mysterious way things are is that they don't create themselves. That's what's actually part of the mystery and beauty, is that a sunset doesn't create itself and that tree didn't create itself. It arises due to, you should say, our experience of it arises due to infinite conditions, like our eyes meeting its colors, and our karmic dispositions and our undistractedness in the moment that just is struck by its raw beauty sometimes. And we can meditate in zazen or in walking, standing or lying down zen. We can meditate on this mysterious aspect of all things by just opening to how everything is not creating itself. It's appears to arise in this mysterious way with the help of everything, including us. And if we're meditating on us, on how I appear to arise in this mysterious way, I don't create myself. That's when we maybe can feel, be in touch with the beauty of ourselves when we realize that how we're not creating ourselves. That's the beautiful way we are. And we have various meditation instructions to point to how to open to this mysterious, non-self-created aspect of anything the dependently arisen aspect of everything, such as the instruction from Dogen Zenji to carry the self forward and confirm that myriad things through me confirming them is delusion. But the myriad things coming forth and confirming the self of the observer is awakening. We let things come forward and create us. You know, this is different than me creating my life. It's being created by the myriad things. This is a meditation instruction on opening to this other dependent quality of things. Then we have another aspect of all things besides this mystery. All things have a mysterious, dependently arisen, other dependent aspect, and they also have this this aspect that kind of blocks their mysterious quality when we basically name things. We have a word and we put that word onto some part of the mystery. In a way, that's what words are doing. They're like, the mystery has no parts, actually. Beauty has no parts. So if you start to try to analyze the different parts of beauty, it starts to become less beautiful, usually. You start to analyze a sunset and how it's happening, try to figure it out, we lose touch with the beauty and then it becomes something else. But when we're just directly experiencing how things are appearing in the moment, without getting a hold of them, that's beautiful and mysterious. Maybe we can call that also direct experience. But then we live in a world of words and language, so we look at the tree and say, maybe we remember how we were struck by its beauty before, and then we think, oh yeah, that's that crab apple tree, it's so beautiful. And we're like, we've lost touch with the mystery. We've made it into a crab apple tree. We've thingified it. The mystery isn't a thing and has no things actually, but words inevitably thingify the mystery. They make it into things, or even the mystery itself. Like right now, just even calling that beautiful, mysterious thing the mystery is already thingifying it. So maybe I've already lost touch with it as soon as I started talking about it, because this is the realm of words. And we have to do this. So all things have that, if they're things, they have this thingified aspect that's created by words and language. As soon as there's a word, there's a thing. The mystery becomes a thing. So we can walk out the door and have a direct experience of this petal snowing crab apple tree, and be struck by its beauty, and then name it. Even to call it beautiful, it already makes it into a thing. It makes beauty into a thing. I think Suzuki Roshi once said something like, to call a flower beautiful is a sin. Something like that. I'm not sure if you use the word sin. Maybe. It's not so bad, but, you know, it kind of kills its beauty in a way, to call it beautiful. And we like to share the beauty with others, so isn't that beautiful? But that we can't help but diminish it by trying to, convey our sense of beauty. So in Zazen, there's a way in which we're all just sitting in our own mystery. We're silently not conveying it to each other. It's very intimate and beautiful. And then sometimes we start talking afterwards and we lose that quality. And we seem to lose it. That's part of the program, seems to be. So then all these phenomena and things, whether we're calling them things or not, provisionally calling the tree a thing, even in its beautiful aspect, just to make this point, we're saying that the tree, the thing of the tree, has this mysterious aspect where it's actually not a thing, but we say, to talk about it, we say the tree has this way that it's actually not really a tree, and yet there's some mysterious appearance there. And then it has this way that it's called a tree, and it becomes a thing. And it seems that as soon as the name gets put on it, it seems to have its own essence. It seems to actually exist from its own side, not created by mind and the universe in an inconceivable way. We get a hold of it, and it's kind of like ordinary. Just a tree. There's lots of them around everywhere. Even other blooming trees in the spring. It's no big deal. So the thing has this mysterious aspect where it's not a thing. It has this named aspect that makes it into an essentially existent thing. And then it has this third aspect also. Called suchness. The suchness of the tree. And suchness is the way that the thingifying never actually reaches the mystery of it. That the word tree that makes it into an essential tree immediately, as soon as the word arises, it kind of solidifies it. It freezes the flow into like separate existence. The way that word that thingifies it never really actually ever can limit the mystery, never can reach the mystery, never can distort the mystery, really. It seems to, continuously, every time we have a thought with a word connected to it, or, you know, even without, I think we don't need to actually say words to do this. Basically, any conceptual thought is actually thingifying the mystery, the undefined, unseparated mystery. So, things, so-called things, have this aspect of suchness, which is hard to talk about. In fact, you know, actually impossible to talk about. I mean, as soon as we talk about it, it becomes thingified suchness. But the definition of suchness is the way that the thingification and the words don't ever reach this appearing magical miracle of the beauty of what we call this world. So one time, Bodhidharma's disciple Huayka came to him, and Bodhidharma was often instructing him to cease involvements with what appears to be the thingified external world apart from mind. Cease involvements with this world of separate, reified things. Cease involvement with it might mean just relax into the mystery of this world before there's things. Might be a way to cease in involvement with the thingification process. Maybe possible during Zazen. So Huayka was maybe working on this for a while, and at one point he came to Bodhidharma and said, okay, I've ceased all involvements with the world of things apart from mind, existing in and of themselves apart from this mind. I've ceased all involvements. And Bodhidharma said, well, that sounds kind of like nihilism. Like, are you saying that there's like nothing at all? If you're saying like, are you saying that there's no world at all? And Huayka said, no. I'm not saying that. Because you're right, that would be disrespecting the mystery. And Bodhidharma said, well, can you prove that you haven't just, like, negated the whole world? And Awaika said, yes, I am always clearly aware and words don't reach it. And Bodhidharma said, that's right. That's the nature of mind realized by all Buddhas. Have no further doubts. I'm always clearly aware is like the undifferentiated mystery, like the impact of those falling blossoms, how that appearance comes to be is beyond us. And clearly aware, I would propose in this case, is like just being with what's happening, what appears to be happening. We could also call this, in classic meditation practice, mindfulness. I think we can say that mindfulness practice, just being aware of the body, feelings, breath, which are all just appearances to our consciousness, being presently aware of them, mindful of these impermanent phenomena, is getting in touch with the mystery. The more we are just presently aware of these appearances, the more we're opening to this undefined mystery. Mindfulness, clear awareness, without actually labeling all the stuff, but just hearing sound, seeing colors, feeling bodily sensations without having to, you know, put a name on them. That's just the appearance of our world in mindfulness. That's of the other dependent world, the world that arises interdependently with everything. I'm always clearly aware, and words don't reach it. So my thingifying doesn't reach this experience, the experience of what appears to be happening. And we could say our experience, and that's what an experience is. Our experience is our version of what's happening. It's like when we're in touch with what's appearing to happen. I qualify by appearing because that's how this mystery is. It's just like, it seems to be appearing. But if we say we're experiencing what's actually happening, I think that's already thingified it. If we say, like, for example, I'm seeing a color, it's not just the appearance of a color, but I'm actually seeing a color. To say that makes it like already a thing. And words then reach it. And so this is not Huayka's and Bodhidharma's practice anymore. But the clear awareness that words don't reach, the clear mystery that this thingifying word limiting quality doesn't reach, that's just the mystery. And the way the words don't reach it, the way the words actually can't ever really reach it, is the suchness, of the moment. It's not so much that the suchness is just the mystery without the words on it. It's a little bit different than that. It's that the suchness is the unreachability, the way that the words never reach it. And we have this word emptiness, right? It's the emptiness of that thing, of the things in the mystery, the emptiness of the words that make the undifferentiated display of life into things. So even though suchness is it's definitely not a thing. It's the absence of all things in this mystery. The Buddhas say that's the object of observation to free our minds from believing that the mystery is actually things. Can you follow that sentence? The suchness is the object of observation in meditation. It's the focus of observation in meditation to free our minds from believing that the mystery is actually things. In other words, we're focusing on the way that actually the mystery is not things. The absence of things in the mystery is suchness. The absence of things in the mystery is the object of meditation, rather than meditating on the mystery. I think sometimes it is actually helpful to necessary and helpful to first just start opening to this mysterious quality of things. By practicing mindfulness, to actually just be aware of this body and sound and colors. Actually be aware of that apparent world. That's not suchness, but that's first we're settling into the present experience. And then the next step to actually meditate on suchness would be to actually start looking at this very subtle thing that the mind is continuously doing of thingifying. Even when we're practicing mindfulness like that, I'm just aware of sensations. It's like there's this way in which we're actually making them into things, either in a big way, like if we're really obsessed about some storyline during Zazen, it's like that, then we're really involved in this imputing of essence onto things. But even if we're just practicing mindfulness of whatever, body, feelings and all, there's a way in which we're very subtly relating to those as kind of separate aspects of the mystery. It's not just undifferentiated mystery awareness. There's red, and then there's blue, and then there's leg pain, and then there's another thought. So if we can start to see how we're like making things out of this mystery, we can see how that those ideas, those concepts of the mind, don't actually, you know, that they're just extra, they're just part of the display of what's happening. They're part of what our minds do very naturally. And it's not a matter of stopping doing that, it's just a matter of seeing how those aren't what's really happening. Anything we say or think is not what's really happening. And to understand that more and more deeply is starting to open to suchness. And then, even if we're opening to suchness, we don't disrespect this mysterious appearing aspect. So Dogen has this essay called Painting of a Rice Cake. Based on the saying that painted rice cakes don't satisfy hunger. So, which is a metaphor in old days for written or spoken teachings are not going to actually satisfy our hunger for truth or our relief from suffering. That actually we need to practice and embody truth. So it's kind of a, if we take that in the classical way completely, it's like, well, we shouldn't even really be talking about Dharma things at all, because this is all just paintings of a rice cake. And sutras are just paintings of a rice cake. We actually have to just sit down, be mindful, and then notice how the thoughts aren't it. But in fact, we would never even think of sitting down and being mindful if we hadn't heard some teaching about doing that. So even the people who first coined the phrase that a painting of a rice cake doesn't satisfy hunger probably had read a lot of painted rice cakes in order to bother saying that. But Dogen, in his great compassion, praises paintings of rice cakes. Painting is like, if we're saying it's just an image, you know, a conceptual image of something, of the truth, in a word form. That's what a painting of a rice cake is. It's a conceptual image put into words in the form of like a sutra or something. It's not the real thing, it's just words. But Dogen says that his late teacher said, a tall bamboo and a plantain appear in a painting. Now, I don't know why he said that. It's kind of a weird thing to say. Maybe we don't know the context. But he said, a tall bamboo and a plantain appear in a painting. Maybe he actually pointed to out in the garden of the temple where there was a bamboo and a plantain tree. And I said, actually, they're just appearing in a painting. In other words, your mind is actually creating a painting of them. That's not, you're not really seeing them. You're seeing your version, your thingified version of them. And this, and I am too. That's why I could call them a bamboo and a plantain. But actually, as Dogen says, a plantain, if we're really, it's not just this thing that looks like a tree. He says, a plantain has earth, water, fire, wind, emptiness, mind, consciousness, and wisdom as its roots, stems, branches, leaves, flowers, fruits, colors, and form. In other words, it's way beyond this little painting we have of it. It's totally a mystery what it is. It includes all of this. Accordingly, the plantain wears the autumn wind and is torn in the autumn wind. We know that it is pure and clear, and that not a single particle is excluded from this, from the mystery of the plantain. The dependently arisen aspect of the plantain includes everything. Not a single particle is excluded. And if we're talking from the point of view of mind, that it's depending on our seeing it, is what it's depending on. Dogen says, there is no muscle in the eye, there is no pigment in the paints. When I read that earlier today, I started kind of like crying and laughing at the same time. That phrase really struck me, and it's not now. That's how these things go. What is it about? There is no muscle in the eye. There is no pigment in the paints. We're seeing the plantain tree, the image of the tree. But actually, the color that appears there is not really there. And the muscles in the eye that seem to be, like, according to biologists, make this vision of the tree possible. There's no muscle in the eye, in this eye that we're talking about. The eye is not what we think it is, and the color of the tree is not what we think it is either. And yet, amazing, we can actually have this awareness of this appearing mystery that we call a plantain or a crabapple tree. There's no muscle in the eye, there's no pigment in the paints. This is emancipation right here. As emancipation is not a matter of time, it's not concerned with a discussion of a certain moment or instant. Time is also a painting. What appears to be happening in this moment is not happening in this moment, and it's not happening the way we think it is. But it's not that there's nothing happening. That would be nihilism. It's just that words and any ideas don't reach what's happening. Yet it appears to be getting darker. The world is appearing to turn, though we can't feel it. Taking up this understanding, make earth, water, wind, and fire your vital activity. Make mind, consciousness, and wisdom your great death. In this manner, the activities of the house have been passed on with spring, autumn, winter, and summer as furnishings. So, Buddha's house is being passed along, but and spring, summer, fall, and winter are like these like furnishings that appear in the house, but there aren't really spring, summer, winter, and fall. Those are paintings. Now the fluctuations of the tall bamboo and the plantain are a painting. The bamboo pole is just long. This pole is just short. This pole is just long. That pole is just short. as these are all paintings, the painted forms of long and short always accord with each other. So obviously, right, long and short are painted ideas, and they change depending on what you put the long thing next to. If you put the long thing next to a really, really long thing, it's suddenly short. So long is a painting, and short is a painting. When you paint something long, it cannot be without painting something short. Thoroughly investigate the meaning of this. Because the entire world and all phenomena are a painting, human existence appears from a painting, and Buddha ancestors are actualized from a painting. Since this is so, there is no remedy for satisfying hunger other than a painted rice cake. That's the conclusion in the end. There's no remedy for satisfying hunger other than a painting of a rice cake. In other words, don't we sometimes think that we want the real thing, like unadorned by any words, unblemished by any concept? We want direct experience now! But actually, the only remedy for satisfying hunger is a painted rice cake. Without painted hunger, you never become a true person. So, we might think, I shouldn't actually want to realize suchness, because that's just another idea, and that's just a gaining idea, right? And it's just more painting, so just might as well just forget it from the start. But without painted hunger, you never become a true person. There's no understanding other than painted satisfaction. In fact, satisfying hunger, satisfying no hunger, not satisfying hunger, and not satisfying no hunger cannot be attained or spoken of without painted hunger. For some time, study all of these as a painted rice cake, which is all that it is. When you understand this meaning with your body and mind, you will thoroughly master the ability to turn things and be turned by things. In other words, you will wallow in the mystery where you don't create yourself. You'll be turned by things and turn things inconceivably. If this is not done, the power of the study of the way is not yet realized. To enact this ability is to actualize the painting of enlightenment. Weird, huh? So that was all just a painting and kind of rambling, kind of abstract painting at that. Please excuse me if it doesn't look beautiful in the kind of classical, orderly kind of way that the Renaissance paintings might look. Do you have any questions? Yes.
Maybe a comment, but a basic question, I don't know. It's helpful for me to think in terms of practice. Practice living. As you're talking about the crab apple tree, you know, what it's doing at the moment, and suchness, I realized that maybe what I'm doing when I am approaching suchness is experiencing experience.
Uh, have been thinking of it, of this, of suchness as not an experience.
No, I didn't say an experience. Mm-hmm. I didn't say experience an experience. I said experience experiencing.
Mm. But even isn't experiencing more like the mystery, if we're looking at these three different things?
I'm not gonna buy your noun. I'm not gonna buy your noun.
What, the mystery?
Of the mystery or the experience. I'm only gonna buy the gerund, experiencing the experiencing. And I can't experience the experiencing without the painted rice cake.
You can't experience the experiencing without the painted. But so you're saying that the experience is the painted rice cake, but the experiencing...
No.
Say again.
It takes profound settling into the conventional. Things as they appear. Which is the painted rice cake.
Well, actually, I'm kind of saying the way that the appearance is like the mystery.
No.
Boom, the tree. It appears.
Mm-hmm. Not the appearance. The appearing is. For me, it's about practicing. It's about being as a gerund. And it's that place in a koan between where the question ends and the answer begins. It's a dynamic stillness. Dynamic is the key, dynamic stillness. Painted rice cake, when seen as this, is not dynamic. But seeing and having it see back, being together, that is a dynamic thing. Experiencing is ineffable. But it's something one does or can do.
If it's ineffable and inconceivable,
right,
I'll go with it.
It was doable.
Doable? The practice of approach is doable. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
I think suchness is not doable, but the practice of approaching it is doable.
Well, suchness as a thing is not suchness. Suchness, in my view, is experiencing.
Well, yeah, I mean, anything we say about it is not it. Even that, right?
Well, but it's I can do it. I just can't. I can't objectify what has been done, but I can be in the act of doing it, and I think that's the point. Mm. My life is different in its conventional sense, when I am doing that, as opposed to when I'm not doing that.
And are you sure you want to say that you're doing it?
Well,
how about it's being realized? That has a different flavor to me than I'm doing it.
Well, I say that because we're dealing in a conventional world. I'm not suggesting. To get to that ultimate place, to get to the third column, to that which is pointed to, I believe one has to be actively engaged in experiencing.
One definitely has to be, I'm painting various pictures of experiencing. In my mind, to try to get a hold.
Experiencing, there's no I in there.
Mm-hmm.
Experiencing does not have an
I. I think we definitely need to be coursing in the mystery. We can't leap to it, because the suchness is only in relation to the mystery. And it's actually also in relation to the painting or the thingifying word thing, because it's just seeing how the words aren't reaching the mystery.
Seeing how, yes, that's like experiencing.
Okay. Experiencing. I'll contemplate it.
Yes.
Yes.
Would you say that by calling calling suchness suchness, it's like labeling the tree a tree. It brings it down to a, it takes the mystery from it.
Yeah.
It tries to label it. Mm-hmm. So, is there a way to say suchness without saying suchness?
Also, all three of these aspects have the other three. So suchness has a mysterious aspect, that the word suchness and what it represents is something appear, you know, there's some concept appearing about it, and we make it into a thing and we use the word suchness, and then there's the suchness of suchness. That's how the word suchness doesn't reach the mystery of suchness. Does that make sense?
A little bit, yeah.
I think this is really a wonderful dynamic thing to meditate on, and how the thingifying aspect, actually this is, I think, maybe the most wonderful. You can, you know, these three, if you kind of get a sense of how these three work together, each of the three has each of the three, and to contemplate how that works is, I think, very helpful. So you take the thingifying, imputing, reifying, thingifying aspect of the tree, and see how that very delusion that we're continuously doing is actually it itself in its actually arising. Pure arising appearance, it's just part of the mystery. It's just another part of the mystery, the fact that humans are capable of doing this and almost incapable of stopping doing this. And it has this thingified thing where we really think that it's, that reification really is reification. And then the beautiful thing is that this reification, this delusion, has a quality of suchness. Without doing anything about it, without making it into suchness, in its actual nature, it is suchness. And that's what I think Dogen's playing with in this painting of a rice cake. That's why he can say, there's nothing but painted hunger, and there's no satisfaction but painted satisfaction. But painted hunger, painted satisfaction, painted rice cakes are actually suchness. And as soon as I said that, suchness just became a painted rice cake. Yes?
I'm just reminded the other day you said something about the usefulness of memorizing certain texts.
Mm.
Of course, the ones that I know are not from this tradition, but from my previous tradition. And there's a Kagyu lineage chant that I love dearly and know by heart. And one of the lines in it is, well, the stanza is about the essence of thought is Dharmakaya as is taught, nothing whatever, but everything arises from it. And then one refers to oneself to this meditator who arises in continuous play. And this last line I've been thinking about with the painted, what is it? The painted
rice
cake. Thank you.
Anything, really.
Right. Grant your blessings so that I realize the inseparability of samsara and nirvana. So I've been, it seems that this teaching is pointing to that inseparability of samsara and nirvana.
Yes, very much. And it's not about changing reality in the slightest. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and the beautiful thing about saying that all things have these three aspects, it's not saying, well, can we just eliminate this one and maybe even this one?
Because those are samsaric ones.
Yeah, it's like nothing's eliminated because they're always there. It's just if you see the relationship between the three, then there's no problem. So, and I think most great, meditations and practices and realizations are actually not about changing anything. They're just about like a shift of perspective, which is therefore, yeah, samsara and nirvana can be not two. We dedicate any merit arising from this conversation to the realization of all these three qualities of all things, how they work together as good friends to create this world of suffering and freedom. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. To enter them, Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.